The Freedom Train has gone from Canada's west coast to Toronto. The Yinka Dene Alliance organized the train to raise awareness of its opposition to the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. The proposed pipeline will go from the Alberta tar sands to the Pacific Coast port of Kitimat, British Columbia, through about 50 First Nations territories. Roland Woodward lives near the tar sands, about 30 kilometers from Fort McMurray, Alberta. He got on the Freedom Train in Jasper to ride with the Yinka Dene Alliance to Toronto. Roland Woodward is the chair of Keepers of the Water Athabasca and a member of Fort McMurray First Nations and Woodland Cree First Nation. He was in Winnipeg and talked to Mud and Water about the impact of the tar sands and other industrial development on First Nations communities and the Athabasca River and Lake watershed. So I wanted to first ask you about the water in your community. And at the water ceremony yesterday, you talked about how you can't drink the water, how it's toxic. What's happened to the water?
Basically, over the years, what's happened is all the way from the headwaters of the Athabasca, which is Jasper, the Athabasca Glacier, to my community, all the way down to Fort Lake Athabasca. What's happened is they built a bunch of pulp mills in Hinton and White Court and a few other places, and that contributed to the toxicity of the water. And then when they started Syncrude and Suncor, well, they're putting more stuff back into the water because the regulations at that time were not as stringent as this time, so they basically turned our water into I don't know what, but people washing it, they get all of a sudden their skin starts weeping and gets sores. You can't drink it. The animals, the fish are dying, the fish are all poisoned. You're not allowed to eat fish out of the Athabasca. So over the years, we've seen a lot of changes. You know, there's less water in the Athabasca now because of withdrawal. Like each oil company withdraws 7 barrels of water just to make 1 barrel of oil. Now that water's gone. Once they turn it to steam and stuff, and we'll never be able to use it or see it again. You know. So there's a lot of bad things. Now with the new SAGD, like that was, before I was talking about open pit mining. Now they're using SAGD, which reaches the deeper oil formation. They inject steam down, and they've got carrier pipes, collector pipes underneath. They collect the heavy bitumen and bring it back up. You know, there again you're losing all that water for steam, and that's all potable water. They keep saying they're using saline water because there's a big salt sea, you know, 900 feet underneath us. They're saying, oh, they're sucking the water out of there and they're using that for steam injection. And I said, well, you can't just do that. You have to make or take some of the salt out of that water before you can use it. Oh, yeah, we're doing that, they said. And I said, well, what are you doing with the salt? Oh, one oil company said, oh, we're going to truck it to Swan Hills, our waste disposal area in Alberta. The other company says, oh, we're going to dig a pit and we're going to line it and we're going to put all that salt in there. And I'm saying, what happens if those things break? The land, the water, everything will be polluted. The other thing is that they're injecting all these chemicals and stuff back into that salt water formation. And they said, oh, it won't affect us. I'm saying, what do you mean? That salt water comes up, I know it comes up at Grand Rapids and it comes up on the Christina River. So water comes up, it doesn't just go down all the time, you know. But they have scientists. And their scientists have this little degree that says they know everything. So they don't look at traditional knowledge, you know. In northern Alberta, we did this one guy, McEachern, I think his name is, did a study on how the effects of clear-cutting was going to happen on the land, because they're clear-cutting all the land at the same time for pulp mills. And they said, scientists, their models said, oh, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. They asked the elders what was going to happen, and on land that they were familiar with, they came out with way better model projections and they were right on than the scientists did. So what does that tell you? The people of the land know the land better than the scientists that they fly in.
In terms of the people living in your community, what sort of health effects, negative health effects, have you seen because of the industrial activity in your area?
Well, a lot of the medical effects that we're noticing are cancers, weird cancers, higher majority of cancers. I don't know if that's because we can detect it quicker, but it's happening. There's liver problems, other health issues, and then there's a social issue, you know, where the people come into town and they're, you know, they're inundated with alcohol and drugs, and pretty soon you've got those ills. And it's sad to see what's happening to the native people up there. You know, a lot of the young people have no hope of ever getting a good job with the oil companies or ever getting a good job because, you know, like I said before, you know, they ask for grade 12, the schools go to grade 9. So where they send the kids out to Edmonton or wherever to go to school, they get to Edmonton, they're 16, 17 years old, what are they going to do? They're not going to study and try and get their grade 12, especially when they get to Edmonton, they go look for other native people, what's happening with them? They fall into the wrong crowd, you know, so...
Have the oil companies made any efforts to help your community or other First Nations communities in Alberta that are on the land that they're using or that they're around?
Basically what happened, they're starting to do some help now, but that was because it was forced. The community of Mackay has a long-term study on the effects, and they got Dr. O'Connor doing it. They hired him. He was a doctor that lost his license because he told about the cancers, the weird cancers that were arriving in Fort Chip, which is just downstream of my communities. You know, I still call Fort Chip my one of my communities too, because it always, I've always, my relatives, so the oil companies are funding that, but it's at what cost? Is it, you know, they're not trying to fix the problem. All they want to do is monitor it to see how, you know, I always say to see how many people die, you know, because my people are dying of the effects of what's happening to the land. You know, it's the air we breathe. You know, you go in the community of Fort McMurray and little kids, and it's not only native kids, it's all the kids start coughing and wheezing and have asthma. They take them out dead, and 2 days later, nothing's bothering them. So it's cause and effect. You know, what's causing it in McMurray is affecting them in a certain way, but when they go out into a different community, it's not affecting them the same way. So where's the correlation, you know? Where's the problem? But the oil companies don't want to look at problems, and they certainly aren't looking for solutions. They just want to mine oil.
Keepers of the Water Athabasca is an organization that you're involved with. What are you doing through Keepers of the Water to fight back and protect your water?
Well, one of the things we're doing is we're partnering with scientists, Dr. Timoney, Dr. Schindler, Dr. O'Connor. I forget the guy with the air doctor, but he's got a doctorate in air. And they're working with us, and they're doing studies. One of the studies we're looking at is the University of Saskatchewan and the University of Manitoba are doing traditional knowledge studies and food studies. We call it the food studies, the fishing derbies. We go along 4 times a year. We just started this last year, and 4 times a year we go and we catch fish. We send it to the University of Saskatchewan, and they find out what's in the fish. And we're doing it upstream of the Fort McMurray, Fort Mackay, Fort Chippewa, and Fort Smith. So we're covering the whole river, you know, the Athabasca River and the Slave River. One of the other things we're doing is alternative energy projects. You know, it was sad when they wanted to sign the Fraser Declaration. I was had to be in Fort Chip because we had just finished doing an energy audit of the community, so they have some understanding of baseline study of what's happening in the community, and our next step is outfitting a couple houses with solar, wind, or some sort of alternative energy to oil. We're collecting traditional knowledge information. One of the things we try to do is be proactive. If we see a problem, rather than saying, oh, this is a problem, and crying about it, we try and find an alternative way of dealing with it. You know, that's just some of the projects. We're also doing water monitoring projects, you know. Next week, it's the end of the month, we're with some organization called Water Matters, and we've got a meeting, and that's to do with more water monitoring. You know, we've got people along the river that go along and take samples and see what's in it. So we're trying to do all we can, but what we're trying to do is fight them with their own weapons. You know, if they bring scientists in, we'll bring scientists in. You know, that's what we're trying to do.
Have you been successful in getting youth in your community involved in some of the work that you're doing with Keepers of the Water?
Yes, we have. In Fort Chippewa, we started a sort of a little media organization, so the kids can Facebook and get all their thoughts out to the world, you know. In the Fort McMurray area, we get them involved in summer projects, try and get them into summer. We're trying to get a youth camp going, And so far the funding hasn't come about, but we've still got a few months to worry about that. So yeah, the youth are, you know, when we have our meetings, our gatherings, our healing walk, one of the biggest things we do is a healing walk every year around the tar ponds, praying for Mother Earth. It's non-political, everybody's invited. In fact, the more people that come, August the 4th this year, it's about an 8-mile walk, it takes a couple hours, but you look at the people in that walk, the majority of them are youth. So yeah, we're bringing more youth into our organization. We've got a youth component. You see us traveling. I travel with my son, but he's a youth, but he also helps me. When we go back to the communities, he goes out and tells his friends what's happening. You see Brent with us, another youth from another community. And then you see Kaya. And she's from BC, and she's a beautiful girl. So, yeah, youth are getting involved in environmental issues.
So you're heading to Toronto this evening with the Yinka Dene Alliance, and we'll be going to the Enbridge meeting in Toronto. Why was it important for you to travel with the Yinka Dene and show solidarity with their fight?
I guess when we got involved with the Yinka Dene a year or so ago, my reason for getting involved was we don't need more pipelines. They build more pipelines, we get more oil companies. We get more oil companies, we get less land to hunt on, no fish to eat, no jobs, no place to go picking berries. And we, you know, as I said before, we've got all these health effects that are being caused by the air, the water, you know, the effects of some of the acid rain on the plants. We can't pick all our medicine plants in the same areas that we're used to, because of the acid rain and stuff. And so my thing was rather than ramp up and trying to get 3 million barrels a day of, you know, which is what they're trying to do right now. They're building, you know, 4 or 5 new oil plants as we speak, just to fill that pipeline. You know, the same with the way with the pipeline to Texas. I went to Ottawa and was one of the first ones to get arrested, walk crossing the line, protesting the pipeline. Not because I don't like pipelines, it's because I don't want more rapid development. See, I'm not against development, I just want it more cleaner and more sustainable. The way they're doing it now is ridiculous. Now, I just mentioned 3 million barrels of oil, 7 barrels of water to convert that to oil, to clean it up and to make it into usable oil. Now, what happened to the 7 barrels of water? 7 times 3, 21 million barrels of water going to waste every year. You know, they have technology that they call a closed loop system, where they can develop these tar sands, put in a closed loop system, and use 95% of the water without wasting it. But they say, oh, it costs too much, we can't do that. Well, what's the cost to our health? What's the cost to the planet? What's the cost to the fish? No. What is cost? Cash. They print cash every day. And we know the oil sands is oil. Oil means money. So they're making it.
my last question for non-First Nations people. How can we, you know, support you in your fight to, and show solidarity with what you're doing?
One of the things I have problems with when I say non-First Nations, because I live in a community where it's sort of integrated. And it's not only the First Nations that are getting in a fight, that are getting hurt and getting sick. It's everybody. Up to this point, it's the only ones that have been against heavy development and have any money to do anything against it are the First Nations. The other side of the population, they're up there for jobs. You know, 1964, we had a winter population of 500, a summer population of 1,500 people that come to work in the boats and fishing and other things that were logging that were going on in the community, and then they'd leave. Well, then they just started developing the oil sands plants, and they brought 5,000 families in one summer, and, you know, it changed everything. It changed our mayor. The oil companies told their workers to get involved in community activities. So pretty soon, the mayor and all the council were working for the oil companies and doing whatever the oil company wanted. And that's what's happening right now is, you know, and they're not realizing they're causing their own illnesses. They're up there thinking, oh, we're going to make big money, but we're going to leave in a few years. Well, I've seen families up there since 1964 that can't afford to leave. And they've made big money all that time. Money, you live within your means. The more you make, the more you need, it seems. And how do you help us? I think our greatest support as we come along are the non-native communities, the writers, the speakers, the raging grannies, you know, the different organizations that are assisting us on this trip, worldwide organizations, you know. And they're all behind us. We're Twitter feed. You know, once we get the knowledge out there, once we get the problems out there, the people can make their own decisions. And how do they help? It comes down to one person, one vote. If the government doesn't agree with us, then they can help us change the government. Otherwise, you know, as one of the chiefs said, if they come across his traditional territory, he's going to the wall. Well, I've been to the wall before. You know, I've seen what's happened in my community in Fort McMurray when they started developing housing. You know, they moved the people that were living on the land on the outskirts of town further out the edge of town. Finally, they said, oh, you can't live there anymore. And we had a group of people on the SNI and seven families. And we were negotiating housing because they were living in poverty-stricken houses, shacks, negotiating housing. Government of Alberta was willing to give us so much money for the land. The oil company, Syncrude, was going to give us housing. We got a new mayor elected. He went out and found his negotiating team on behalf of the natives. They bypassed me. Six families got trailers. The city of McMurray got $180,000 to provide land instead of providing, well, they did provide land, but they used $140,000 of that to put in water and sewer in one block. And they put these six trailers on basically two city lots. A city lot is 40 by 100, 110. So these people are sitting on 80 feet by 110. Six trailers. One guy, Pat Schott, he was part of the original planning group. He said, I will not move until they give me my own house and my own land. While he was at work, his wife phoned him and said, they've got a bulldozer here and they're going to bulldoze. By the time he got back to his house was flat. He went running into his he had a shed there where his skidoos and all his boat motors and everything were in, and tried to grab his guns and to save them. The police threw him in jail. So by I get down there, he's already gone away. We put up a little camp, demonstration camp. Somebody called the mayor a Nazi, and he got all upset, but Pat Schott got his own place, his own piece of house, his own little chunk of land. But these people, instead of getting it for nothing, got it on a rental basis. So for the last 30 years, they've been paying rent, and as the family dies off, they pull a trailer out. So now there's only two trailers there. One old lady is too old. They moved her to a nursing home. So, you know, within 5 years, there will be no more trailers left, and the city will have a nice piece of property developed and turn it into another community center or whatever. You know, it's not enough land to turn into a community center, but they'll sell it to a church or something. The people have not reaped any benefits of anything. You know, when in the 70s and the 80s, I was into big construction, you know, and I tried to help. But all the jobs I got, 90-95% Native employees, we did good work, fast work. But the oil company wasn't interested in that, you know. And you start arguing against them, and contracts get less and less. And pretty soon I had to go, 100 miles to find a job. Pretty soon it was 1,000 miles. And, you know, it gets ridiculous because they blackball you. So, at that point I'd made enough money and I thought I'd decide to retire in 86 and go back to school, get my anthropology degree. Now, I raised five kids. Three of them have got degrees. The fourth one was a sailor, and he was also a medic. And he's looking after the old people in Edmonton, works for some company. And I've got Cody. Cody, I'm trying to lead a different route. You know, he's more of an environmentalist. He likes videotaping and stuff like that, so I take him along. He helps me in a lot of ways, and it's great. You know, I see a different future for him. Future. I guess I'm training him to take on my job.
My conversation with Roland Woodward, chair of Keepers of the Water Athabasca, was recorded on May 6, 2012, while he was in Winnipeg with the Freedom Train. There's more information at keepersofthewater.ca and freedomtrain2012.com. This is Mud and Water, and I'm Karen McIntosh.